We live in a democracy, and I believe democracy works best when every eligible voter has an opportunity to vote and to have their voice heard. Democracy works best when there is high participation and high levels of civic engagement. Why is it important to business? Our business is built upon having a stable democracy. The recent history would suggest we're on the precipice of an unstable democracy, and it could have significant impact to all American businesses if something tragic in this country happens to our democracy. And so that fundamentally is the business rationale behind it.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. I'm Roman Segal, recovering marketer.
And I'm Andrew Tarvin, humor engineer. Roman and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know, but want to know more about.
It's kind of like being a fly on the wall for my mentoring coffees.
On today's show, we're talking to P&G alumni leader Chip Berg, president and CEO of Levi Strauss & Company. Chip is no stranger to the podcast. In fact, he was one of our very first guests, and we'd encourage you to go back to listen to our first conversation from June of 2020 if you haven't already. But from time to time, we like to go back to some of our favorite guests, go deeper on a topic that they're passionate about. And in this particular case, we wanted to talk to Chip about the evolving role of the CEO, particularly when it comes to things that go beyond the P&L, things like advocacy and activism, something Chip is a strong champion for. So we started our conversation by talking about where Chip learned this idea of what we might call the responsible CEO, who he learned it from, John Smale. John Smale was chairman and CEO of P&G from 1981 to 1990 and the chairman of General Motors from 1992 to 1995. And he is arguably one of the most influential leaders of the modern era. And Chip references a new book about John titled Here Forever, The Timeless Impact of John Smale on Procter & Gamble, General Motors, and the Purpose and Practice of Business, which is available now wherever you get your favorite books. Could be a great gift for any P&G or P&G alumni pal you have in your life as well. It's one that I know that I'm getting pretty soon. But for today's chat with Chip, we talked not just about the impact of John Smale on Chip's life and career, but how Chip thinks about corporate activism and some of the key issues he and Levi's have attempted to tackle, including voter registration, women's reproductive rights, ending gun violence, and climate change. Now, talking about these subjects may feel uncomfortable for some. Speaking for myself, I know I have some very strong beliefs about the topics we covered, but our goal in this episode wasn't to push a specific agenda, but rather to focus on the nonpartisan business reasons for taking a stand on certain issues. And while it's a great conversation that we hope will make you think and feel a little bit more, I do want to make it very clear that these are the views of Chip and myself alone. As always, please reach out with your thoughts and ideas at pgalumpod@gmail.com. Let's go ahead and jump right in because Chip has an incredible wealth of knowledge, along with some actionable examples to share. And we hope you'll enjoy this conversation with Chip Berg, President and CEO of Levi Strauss & Company. Chip, it's an honor to have you back on the podcast to talk about something that's becoming more and more important, not just for companies, but for society. And that's the evolving role of the CEO. And just for our audience's context, I want to get a couple of questions from you about your time at P&G. What year did you start at Procter & Gamble, and what was your role when you first started?
I started in June of 1983. I was a brand assistant. You know, they don't even have brand assistants anymore. So I started really low on the ladder in the food service and lodging products division on the institutional cleaners business.
Okay. And fast forward, what was your final year at P&G and what was your role prior to leaving?
I was a group president for the global men's grooming business. That was in 2011 when I left P&G. So I was running all of the Gillette business as well as the rest of the men's brands in beauty and grooming. So Old Spice and a few other brands as well.
Okay, fantastic. So a nice long career with a lot of experiences, which of course we have the conversation with you from the first time. So if people want to hear a little bit more about that, they can go back and jump through it. So speaking of John Smale specifically, what was your first experience with him?
You know, I it was a long, long time ago, but you know, my first real memory of John Smale was at the year-end annual meetings that the company used to hold down in the Coliseum, down on the riverfront, where everybody would come in from around the world. And I got invited to that. I think I was probably a brand manager at the time, maybe 3 or 4 years with the company. And it was really my first exposure ever seeing him speaking in front of employees. So that was my first experience. But one of my most memorable experiences was not too long thereafter. Again, I was still a brand manager in the food service and lodging products division. You know, that was the division in the United States that sold, we used to call it the itsy bitsy bars of soap and the little bottles of shampoo to places like hotels. And we also had, you know, institutional sizes of shortenings and oils, you know, kind of the institutional version of Crisco and Crisco oil that we sold to restaurants and food service operators. You know, so it was kind of obscure business to some extent and, you know, relatively small and I would say largely not very strategic for the company. But John Smale had a strategy review with the division, and the division manager invited me to the strategy review. You know, I got to sit in the bleacher seats. I remember it was in the company's boardroom and, you know, everybody's wearing suit and tie and everything. And I sat kind of in the back row of the boardroom, but got a chance to watch Smale in action. And, you know, it's indelible. It's burned in my brain. I remember it very, very distinctly.
Yeah. Was there anything from either that, what he talked about then, or even kind of what you learned from him a little bit later that you would say is like something that you pull into yourself or like a lesson that you learned from him specifically, like a takeaway?
Well, yeah, for anybody who hasn't read the book, go read the book because, you know, in reading the book, what I realized is so much of my DNA as a leader, so much of who I am as a leader, I think flows directly from John Smale. From John Smale through John Pepper and Ed Arndt and, you know, all of the other senior leaders who I was closer to as I kind of grew up inside the company, but is his focus on developing talent and, you know, really trusting in people, putting people he believed in into roles of significant responsibility. And trusting them to get the job done, holding them accountable, to be clear, but, you know, giving them the resources and, you know, really expecting them to deliver. He was very, very big on the people front of things. And I don't think it was really coincidental that I was invited to that, you know, very, very early strategy review. I think he probably said to our division manager, I want you to bring some of your top talent. I want them to sit through this strategy session. And so talent was always very big on his agenda, and that has carried with me through my entire career. You know, another thing is just he was always thinking long-term. And there are some great stories in the book. I think one of my favorite stories, and I wasn't close to it at all, you know, I was a brand manager, still in food service and lodging when the company acquired Richardson Vicks. And, you know, we were trying to swoop in as a white knight. There was a competitive offer from Unilever. And to get the deal done, the bank, Goldman, suggested that we put an extra dollar on the table. And I don't know what the total incremental cost of that was. You know, the total acquisition was $1 billion. And you take a look now at the impact that that acquisition had on P&G. It's just incredible. You know, with that acquisition, you got brands like Olay and Pantene and of course the Vicks franchise. And it put the company on the map in a very serious way in Asia where we were basically nowhere. And that extra dollar has paid dividends for for a long time, you know, so always thinking long term. And, you know, he was a man of character, integrity. He was always about doing the right thing. And he was very, very courageous. I think, you know, one last thing, he saw his role as something bigger than just P&G. You know, he understood the role that P&G played in the community in Cincinnati, but also in the world writ large. And he was way ahead of his time, thinking about stakeholder capitalism and the role that P&G played. And I think today, you know, I've been away from it for a long time now, but even still today, the role that P&G plays in the Cincinnati community, the role that he personally played in the Cincinnati community to make the community a better place. He understood that there was a very, very deep connection between the city and how livable it was and P&G's ability to attract great talent. And he spent a lot of time focusing on those important stakeholders.
Which I think is a fantastic segue to, you know, what I want to spend the rest of our conversation around, because it's something that it seems like that has been a thing that you picked up from John and maybe some other leaders as well, because, you know, we first had our conversation with you very early on in the P&G Alumni Podcast, which we thank you for joining us so early on. This is back in June of 2020. And in addition to sharing your story around kind of growing up in New York City area to ROCT, to military, to P&G, to Levi's, you also talked about a little bit that the role of the CEO. And, you know, I've been following you on LinkedIn since then. And one of the things that stuck out to me in particular was after the school shooting in Texas back in May, you had a very kind of clear call to action type post. And you're specifically calling out leaders, yourself included, to speak up more, to let Congress know that something needs to change, and that it was a very clear take on kind of what was going on in the country. And so I'm curious about, if we take a bigger picture, we'll talk about that specifically, but if we take a bigger picture look, though, of the role of the CEO in today's environment, or even what kind of maybe John kind of started to allude to, is what is your take when people say, you know, as a CEO, your job should be focused on running the company, on, you know, profits versus losses, et cetera, and not on political or social issues?
Well, you know, it's certainly a big topic of the day today. And, you know, I think part of the challenge is, where does business begin and business end? And where does politics begin and politics end? But this is not about me. This is about Levi Strauss, the company. And, you know, we've been around for 170 years, so not quite as long as P&G, but almost. And I think there's a lot of similarities between the two companies, which is part of the reason I joined Levi Strauss 11 plus years ago, our values and everything else. But one of the things that distinguishes this company is, and it goes all the way back to our founder, the very first year he made a profit, he donated a percentage of the profit to an orphanage here in San Francisco. And this company has always about profits through principles and making an impact in the world. And so this way predates me. You know, and I can go back through the history of the company and, going back to when we had factories in the United States, we desegregated those factories 10 years before the Civil Rights Act. We have taken stands on the AIDS epidemic very early. Obviously, San Francisco initially was ground zero for that, but we've been engaged in trying to eradicate AIDS for decades now. We were one of the very first companies in the United States that offered healthcare benefits to same-sex partners. We pulled funding from the Boy Scouts when they banned gay troop leaders back in the early 1990s. And, you know, through it all, you know, this company has been on the right side of history. And I think that's the bar to which I measure, you know, in part, whether we weigh in on something or not, is can we make a difference? Does it matter to our employees and to our company? And if so, will history say that we were on the right side of business over time? And there are a number of issues that we've taken stance on over the period of time that I've been CEO. You know, we can talk about guns. We can talk about women's rights, reproductive rights, LGBTQ. I mean, we can go down the list, but at the end of the day, we believe it's important for our business. We weigh in on issues because we believe it is important for our company in some important way. And it does get back to what I was saying about John Smale. He recognized that having a community that was thriving, in which the company is headquartered, that's important. That having a community that has sound infrastructure in the town where the company is headquartered, that's important. And, you know, we've not been shy to weigh in on things that we think over time could negatively impact our ability to operate. You know, we could argue any one of them, whether, you know, we've gone too far or whether it's too political or anything else, but our view is these are all central to the company's ability, long-term ability to attract great talent and to continue to grow and thrive.
I mean, in some ways, the extreme example makes a little bit sense of that, of like you need customers actually out there to do things. And if they're not living a healthier, happier, whatever kind of life, they're not going to be that, right? At the from a purely kind of like profits kind of driven thing, but also the bigger focus, like you said. And so is this a thing that you think you do because it's with Levi's? Like, because I'm thinking about the leader out there that maybe doesn't work for an organization that has that same level of history. So can you do that even if the founder wasn't someone that, you know, donated right away? Is there an opportunity for people to change a culture into that type of behavior?
Yeah. In fact, I mean, I've spent a lot of time engaging CEOs to try to get them to join us on some of these different causes that we've got, you know, whether it's time to vote, we can talk about that. Or, you know, we sent a letter, a CEO letter to Congress to pass the Safer Tomorrow Act not too long ago and got hundreds of CEOs to sign. So I've talked to a lot of CEOs about this. And the reality is, in today's environment, employees more and more are expecting their companies to kind of weigh in on issues that are important to them. And that can be a little bit tricky because, let's be clear, not every employee necessarily agrees with every position that we take as a company. And I understand that. And I truly do appreciate and value the fact that people have different points of view on some of these issues. But young employees today in particular are expecting their companies to weigh in. And that's one thing. The second thing is, it is very clear that CEOs have a platform and they do have a voice. And their voice will be heard if they use it the right way. And we can make a difference. You know, I mean, one example that I'll just highlight, we started this initiative called Time to Vote to encourage other companies to give their employees time off on election day to go vote. And we did this, we started this initiative back before the midterm elections in 2018. Because the midterm elections, not in 2016, but in 2014, were like the worst performing midterm elections ever. You know, people just don't come out to vote the same way they do during presidential elections. And one of the issues that we've got as a country is, unlike almost every other democracy around the world, election day happens to fall on a work day. You know, it's not on a weekend, it's not a holiday, it's a work day. And a lot of people just don't have the time to go vote. So we partnered with PayPal and Patagonia to put together this coalition of the willing of companies to join us in giving their employees time off to vote on election day. I think the first year that we did it in 2018, we got about 500 companies. You know, this year going into the midterm elections, we have over 2,000 companies from 50 states around the world, around the country, representing over 10 million employees. And these companies have all committed that they would give employees time off to vote. And I think it will make a difference. The 2018 midterm elections, the very first year we did this with only about 500 companies, and I'm not saying we uniquely own this because it was a pretty important midterm election, but it was the highest voter turnout and midterm elections in over 100 years. and it made a difference. I think CEOs are starting to recognize that their employees expect it, that they can make a difference, that by mobilizing the business community around important issues, you know, we can have an impact.
Let's talk specifically around this idea of voting. I guess first, why is voting a cause specifically that you think is worth, hey, this is us spending some time and some effort to create this coalition for? Why voting in particular?
Well, you know, we live in a democracy, and I believe democracy works best when every eligible voter has an opportunity to vote and to have their voice heard. And it's important, not just at the national level. I mean, arguably, it's most important at the local level, but at all levels of government, democracy works best when there is high participation and high levels of civic engagement. Why is it important to business? Our business is built upon having a stable democracy. And the recent history in this country would suggest we're kind of on the precipice of an unstable democracy. And it could have significant impact to our company and all American businesses if something tragic in this country happens to our democracy. And that is fundamentally the reason why our business is based on having a stable democracy and a healthy economy. And those two go hand in hand as well. And so that fundamentally is the business rationale behind it.
Which makes a lot of sense. And so I feel like it would be perhaps maybe a little challenging, maybe it's not, but like, because you probably have your own opinions of like the way that you are going to vote, et cetera, which may or may not be the same as other people. Is it a conversation of like, hey, let's vote and also maybe go this direction? Do you try to stay as nonpartisan as possible kind of in the conversation? Is like, hey, whatever you're going to do, just at least exercise that act.
It is totally nonpartisan. We are not attempting to drive votes in one direction or the other. And in fact, you know, a lot of the effort that we've done as a company has been focused on getting people registered. We're running a big program right now focused on community colleges because voter participation in community colleges is much lower than at other colleges, at four-year schools. So we're running programs at community colleges around the United States to get 18-year-olds and older registered to vote. So a big focus on registering people to vote. And then second, voter awareness and voter education. You know, I think what's most important is people going into the polls and voting. And right behind that is that they go in understanding what the issues are and having a point of view on how they're going to vote on those issues and those candidates. Not trying to steer them one direction or the other, but just encouraging people to be well-informed, to be engaged civically, and to go have their vote counted.
With that, though, as I think about specifically community colleges, which I think is a fantastic area to focus on and one of the cool programs that you are building of like, hey, here's a specific actual thing that we can do. But if you think of at least traditionally how younger people tend to vote, say it tends to be a little bit more liberal, is there a nature to say, well, what if they vote in people that increase corporate tax rates or increase the rates of, you know, some of our employees and things like that? Is that, you know, is there a fear that comes along with that? Or are you saying like, nope, the kind of the will of the people, let's get as many people to vote and then kind of the direction that they go is the kind of the direction that we need as an organization?
Yeah, the latter for sure. It is purely, again, back to the fundamental principle that we are a democracy in this country and that democracy works best when every eligible voter has their vote or their voice counted. And that is fundamentally what it is about. It is trying to get people engaged and get them to the polls to vote.
And so one of the strategies that you've done for this is the Time to Vote Coalition, this idea of bringing people together, encouraging. What's the value of a coalition kind of as a strategy rather than just Levi's doing it on their own, but partnering with different groups, but then also encouraging other CEOs? Is it to give them an easy way to join? Is it to encourage it? Like what value does that bring?
Well, our impact is much, much bigger. I mean, if Levi's did it by ourselves, you know, it'd be our U.S. population base of a couple of thousand people. But by joining with all of these other companies now, we could have a much bigger impact. You know, we're now, as I said, around 10 million employees across the country, all 50 states. So We can have a much bigger impact. But the other thing is, I think we can create, you know, momentum behind this idea and hopefully have a positive impact and a positive influence on democracy in this country.
Yeah. And it seems like, I think if I'm sitting here listening to this as a leader, it seems to me like, oh, it's not just Levi's, but here's 2,000 plus. Like, I could take this to my senior leaders. If I'm a CEO, I could, you know, look at joining myself. If not, I could take it to my senior board or my board of directors or whatever to then say, look at all these other. So there's almost a credibility with the quantity or whatever that you're getting. You're getting to a certain mass.
Absolutely. And with 2,000 companies, you can be sure that there are maybe left-leaning companies, right-leaning companies. There are companies from every state in the union, right? And so, and it reinforces this notion that this is not a partisan effort. This is clearly all about getting the vote out. It's that simple.
Yeah. And so, and voting makes a lot of sense, especially in a democracy. Talk to me a little bit about how do you decide on which issues to kind of advocate for? Is it a like thing that you have because of a personal belief? Is it a conversation that you're having with senior leaders? Is there someone on your team that just raises the issues? Like from a actual tactical standpoint that you all go about, okay, this is something that we want to say something about first. And then two, here's what we're going to say, or here's how we're going to take action.
I mean, first of all, we have a framework as a company in areas that we've been, you know, engaged in and acting upon for a long, long time that's been approved by the board of directors. And anything within that framework, if you will, we've got flexibility to maneuver and act pretty quickly. You know, so I've got examples of where we have acted real quickly because it's within the framework. Anything new, we have a process to kind of filter through areas or things that we might get engaged in. And the things that we look at are, first of all, is it important to our employees and or our customers? Number two, is it important to us as a business? Is there a business story behind this? And then number three, as I said, you know, when we look at this over the long term, do we think we can make a difference? And will we be on the right side of history? You know, will history judge me in making that decision as having weighed in on something where we could make a difference and that we were on the right side of history? So that tends to be basically how we work through it. If it's a new area and it, you know, most of these areas, because we live in such a divisive world today, most of these areas are hot potatoes. I engage the board. I mean, almost everything that we've weighed in on over the last 5 years or so has been multiple repetitions with the board of directors to get the board on board, if you will, and behind and supporting our programs. And in many instances, that engagement with the board has strengthened our commitment and has encouraged us to do even more than what we were originally thinking. I mean, a good example is when we decided to weigh in on ending gun violence in this country. We originally went in with, this was right after the Parkland shooting, we originally went in with a one-year program to support some of the youth organizations that were being formed to end gun violence, because young folks are really impacted by gun violence with all of the school shootings. And the board said, you know, in for an inch, in for a mile here. If we're going to do this, let's make it an extended program. Let's put at least $1 million behind this. So we launched the Safer Tomorrow Fund, which we manage with several nonprofit organizations that are committed to ending gun violence. We committed $1 million to it over a four-year period of time, and we're in the fifth year. So we've extended this program and are continuing to work with a number of nonprofit organizations that are committed to ending gun violence in this country.
Wow, which is some impressive support. One, I love the idea of this framework that gives you so that for quicker things that you need to act, et cetera, that it's not every single issue has to always go, you know, in front of a board, because things, you know, either because of time or just the amount, you'd be like, we can't cover anything else based on all these issues that we have to kind of get approval for. So the framework, I think, is a fantastic kind of way to account for that. And it seems like, so the fact that the board went along with like, not only, hey, okay to do this, but let's take it further. Is that an aspect when looking at people on the board? Is it like then a like, hey, we should have people that are of this kind of mindset? Did it just kind of turn out that way? Is it because of Levi's backgrounds that it attracts this type of person to be on the board? Because it seems like if you, you know, maybe you're someone that has this idea, but you go to the board and it's like, what? No, don't do that at all. Versus like, this was the opposite direction of like, go deeper.
Well, the board has, you know, they have a really important governance responsibility to make sure that the company is not about to do something that could, you know, majorly jeopardize the business or the company or the company's reputation. So they have a slightly different job to do, if you will, than the management team. And so their job is to scrutinize everything that we're doing and kind of kick the tires and make sure that we're buttoned up on it and that we thought through the potential implications, because any of these issues, again, because of the world that we live in, you know, not everybody's going to agree. Not everybody is going to like what we're saying or what we're acting upon. And we understand that. They understand that. But they've got a job to do, and they do their job. And there could be instances where they say, we don't think you should do this. And several of the issues that we've weighed in on, it's taken us more than one time with, you know, more than one rep with the board. They don't just roll over and rubber stamp it. They ask the hard questions and send us back to think about it a little bit more and get more data and think through, you know, potential implications. And so the gun violence issue, I think we were back and forth with the board two or three times. You know, we've weighed in on, after Roe v. Wade was turned over by the Supreme Court several months ago, we weighed in on that and a woman's right to, you know, decide for herself what should happen with her body. And, you know, we saw that one coming. So, but we spent quite a bit of time in front of the board on that issue, again, knowing how divisive and how hot that issue is.
What type of questions are you preparing for or helping to resolve? Is it a balance of like you said, is this the right thing to do? Are we standing on the right side of history? Is there also conversation of like, what percentage of our potential customer base are we going to like then upset in this process, to the point that, because we see that sometimes now of like someone takes a stand in a certain area and now people are like, never, you know, use that product again, or don't, in fact, burn it in the streets or that kind of thing. Is that the thing that you're trying to then balance?
We always assess, you know, what the risk is, you know, and I think the way that we managed the women's reproductive rights issue was really good. We focused on the fact that our employee base in the United States is 58% women. And fundamentally, this gets back again, it's a business issue. There is a lot of data on the impact that lack of access to abortion for women can have on employment. And, you know, our employee base is skewed towards women, as I said, and this could have a real negative impact on our ability to attract and retain great talent around the country. And that fundamentally is the business issue behind it. And we've heard from our employees that they want us to stand up for this. And so we were supporting our employees in our statement. And, you know, one of the things that we said is we will support employees to cross state lines if they have to access an abortion. And it's actually in our healthcare benefits and has been for a long, long time. So we make that very, very clear.
Yeah, which I think is the other side of things that I guess that you're also balancing is a really good reminder for people is back to what you said of like, it is a either recruitment and or retrenchment strategy. I mean, ignoring the fact of like trying to keep this as apolitical as possible, like where you actually believe of like personal beliefs. But the idea of like, oh yeah, like you're saying, if the workforce is asking for this by making this stand or making these choices, you are showing and realizing like, no, you're going to retract and retain top talent because you're doing these types of things. So there's that balance. You may lose a couple of customers, but you're gaining a whole group of one, gaining probably customers on the other side, but also the talent that you need to run a successful organization.
Right.
And so we've talked about a couple of topics already. So voter registration, obviously really important right now. Love the idea of time to vote and creating a coalition around it for women's reproductive rights. The idea of like, okay, this is what we can do as an individual company and maybe encourage other people to do it. We've touched upon a little bit around gun violence. And this was the one that kind of attracted my, what it was the first post that I really saw that I was like, this is incredible to kind of stand up in this way. I know that back in 2019, you all, Levi's as a group, kind of circulated a letter to get people to sign on around gun safety legislation. And at least based on this article that I was reading, that not too many organizations actually signed on. But then when you did it again—
Four CEOs signed the first—
Four CEOs, yeah. So then you do it again in June of this year. And now, at least at the time of this article, is like 550.
Right.
So a massive increase.
Right.
I guess two questions. What prompted you to say, no, let's do it? Even though we weren't, you know, super successful the first time of only four, it seems like a low number, to say, no, we've got to do this. And then two, what do you think changed that increased the number?
It's a really good question. So in 2019, there was legislation in the House of Representatives. It was House of Representatives Bill Number 8, which was affectionately known as the Gabby Giffords bill. You may remember she was a congresswoman who was shot in Arizona and nearly killed and has, you know, she has recovered and she's amazing. And her mission now is to end gun violence in this country. But the legislation was named after her. And myself and a couple of other CEOs sent a letter to Congress encouraging them to pass that bill. We tried to get other CEOs to participate, and we couldn't. It was hard. And it did pass the House of Representatives. It then went to the Senate and sat on the Senate leader's desk, Mitch McConnell at the time. It never saw the floor of the Senate. We sent another letter. It was just the four of us again, encouraging it to get moved into the Senate for at least debate and a vote so that the senators could be held accountable for it. Mm-hmm. It never went for a vote. This time, 2022 was different. And I think there were a couple of things that made it different. I think that the almost back-to-back shootings in, I think it was May, between Buffalo and what happened, you know, the tragic racially inspired killings in the supermarket in Buffalo. And I think it was less than 2 weeks later than the shooting in Texas, tragically in a school. A lot of people were just like, that's it. That is the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, what's unsaid is between those two incidents, I think there were 19 other mass shootings in that 2 week period of time. They just didn't get the spotlight the way those two tragic incidents did. But I think a lot of people just kind of got to the point where this is it. You know, we got to do something here. That combined with the fact that we've been the tip of the spear and we've demonstrated, you know, I'm still here 3 years later. I've still got my job. The company's doing great. And I just think there was more of a movement, including gun owners, by the way, who were saying, we've got to put other measures in place to stop this madness. And, you know, to be clear, we're not about repealing the Second Amendment. We're not about taking guns away from gun owners. This is about putting checks and balances in place to make our society a safer place. If you think about it, where are these shootings happening? They're happening in schools. They're happening in synagogues, churches, supermarkets, movie theaters, places that should be safe are no longer safe. And, you know, how many schools now have had fencing put around it and metal detectors and, you know, not allowed to take bags into school anymore? I mean, it's just sad what has transpired here. And I think we just hit the snapping point. And so when the letter went to Congress on the Safer Communities Act, there were about 550 CEOs that had signed. And it's still online. And I think online now, I think we're way above that. So, and I think CEOs are hearing it from their employees. They're hearing it from other stakeholders, from customers. And I think that's what prompted, you know, such amazing turnout. And clearly we made a difference. The legislation passed. It's the first major piece of gun safety legislation that this country has passed in over a decade. And hopefully it will begin to make a difference in making our communities a safer place.
Yeah, which I think is, you know, quite impressive, the change, right? Part of it, I think, is probably maybe public sentiment change because of, like, you know, the things that you said, but then also, you know, that these are, as a democratic and capitalist society, like, for, like, government leaders to see, know that even organizations also potentially believe. Is that kind of the idea? Because obviously with something like time to vote, it's like, oh, well, we can give our employees time. We're not necessarily pushing for change, although change would, you know, making it a federal holiday or whatever for voting might be, you know, another way to go about it. This is a thing where it's like, well, we as individual employees can't end gun violence on our own. So it's got to be almost a legislative thing. Is that the thought, is like, hey, but we are leaders and our voice is a little louder?
And there has been a shift in public opinion, too, for sure. As you said, 84% of Americans support background checks. That includes a lot of gun owners, obviously. And so, as well as an overwhelming majority of Republicans. I mean, you can look at it by demographics, by political party, it doesn't matter. The vast majority of Americans recognize that federal background checks are going to keep guns out of the hands of bad guys. And that is its sole purpose. And it is supported by the vast majority of Americans. And I think that has been a little bit of a pendulum swing over the last couple of years, too, which is, you know, another reason why I think we've seen more CEOs kind of jumping on board here.
Yeah, which I think is great. And yeah, and there's always the argument of things of like, well, it's not going to stop every single bad guy. Well, it's going to stop a lot more. So one last issue that I want to talk about, because it's a big one that overhangs kind of a lot of these things, is also on climate change. Because it's like, okay, we can do all these things, but if we don't necessarily have a habitable planet, you know, they become a little bit less important. And so one of the things that I know Levi's recently announced is this net zero emissions by 2050. And so we've talked about coalitions as one way to create change, you know, letters and things like that. And then this seems like a personal kind of initiative to lead by example. To me, one of the things that stands out apart from, or what seems different than maybe some of the other initiatives or things that I've read or followed, is an emphasis on transparency. Mm-hmm. And so why was that part of the big strategy when you're talking about this as a goal, and how do you actually achieve that?
So first of all, you know, climate change is kind of the existential issue of our day. You know, I've got a 13-year-old daughter, and if you were to ask her what are the biggest things she's concerned about, number one is climate change, what's going to happen to planet Earth over the rest of my lifetime, and number two is gun violence in this country. Those are the two things that she worries about. So it is clearly an existential crisis. And, you know, the apparel industry is not necessarily a good guy when it comes to climate change. We use a lot of water. We use a lot of chemicals. People buy clothes, wear them briefly. Fast fashion has not been great for the, you know, for planet Earth. You know, you buy a cheap t-shirt, wear it two or three times, and then throw it in the garbage, and it winds up in landfill, and all those chemicals and everything else wind up seeping into planet Earth. All not good. And, you know, transparency is very, very important to us. I think consumers are expecting transparency. They want it more and more. In fact, a lot of our innovation right now is to drive how do we give even more transparency. I think, I don't know if it's 5 years or 10 years down the road, consumers are going to want to know everything about the pair of jeans. Where was the cotton grown? Where did the rivets come from? Where was the thread? You know, where was the thread made? Where was the product put together? And, you know, show me a picture of the factory. Show me a picture of the people that made my product. I don't think it's ridiculous to say that at some point in the future, that those are the kind of expectations that consumers are going to want. So we have been, you know, very focused on being very transparent with both our targets as well as our progress against our targets. We put out a sustainability report every year where we're also very transparent about the progress that we're making towards our progress or towards our targets. We've made good progress. Carbon dioxide, you know, versus a 2016 baseline, we've reduced carbon dioxide by 66% versus a target of 90% by 2025. So we're 2/3 of the way there. On electricity, 85% of renewable electricity in our company-operated facilities versus a target of 100%. This is versus 2021. We're already at 85%. So we made good progress there against our target, and I think we'll get there. You know, water, making denim and making jeans is a very water-intensive process, and we have built a number of kind of waterless initiatives where we've been able to significantly reduce the amount of water that we use. We've reduced almost 12 billion liters of water since 2011. We're also recycling water now, and we've significantly reduced the number of chemicals, and we've basically eliminated all dangerous chemicals from our supply chain. And we're also very, very transparent about all of that. So the other thing that's happening is the SEC is going to start really closely regulating a lot of these disclosures, almost to the same rigor as financial disclosures. So if you make a claim, you set a target, you're going to have to report your progress against the target. You're going to have to be able, you're going to have to validate that target. And that higher level of rigor, I think, is going to be good because it should reduce a lot of the greenwashing that's out there. You know, the European Union is also all over false claims and people kind of greenwashing the consumer when there isn't a lot of validity behind what they're saying. And so I think that's all going to be good. I mean, it's going to drive us to a world that is more transparent, where there is more of a level playing field. The standards that the SEC is proposing are pretty rigorous and significant. And, you know, we're still digesting what does it mean for us. But I think we're moving into a world where there is going to be mandatory transparency, and you're going to have to be able to back up your claims too.
Damn. So it sounds like there's a number of reasons for pushing towards net zero emissions and things like that and transparency around it in terms of the good of the planet, et cetera, but also getting ahead of the curve in terms of what things are going to be required in the future. And like you said, especially for younger generations, younger employees, similar to taking a stand there, I think it's a big area of focus. And it seems like, I think in various studies are showing that, you know, the top things that people are focused on are the things that they're going to go into. Younger generations are constantly either saying things around climate change because they know it's one of the only things that may have an impact, or YouTuber, yeah, or social media influencer, maybe the other direction.
Well, you know, the other big thing that we're working on is just reducing consumption. I mean, you know, that's the other big thing here is we're over-consuming society to some extent. And I think the pandemic actually shined a pretty bright light on this. A lot of people, you know, when we were hunkered down and, you know, kind of locked in place, realized that, you know, I don't need to go to the store all the time. I don't need all this stuff in my closet, and which actually plays to Levi's advantage. You know, we're quality that never goes out of style, I like to say. Mm-hmm. You know, a pair of 501s from 20 years ago is still good today type of thing. You buy a trucker jacket today, you're going to be handing it down to your grandchildren in 25 years kind of thing. And, you know, actually the advertising that we're running right now around the world is called Buy Better, Wear Longer. And I think a lot of consumers have kind of wised up to the fact that a lot of fast fashion brands, which offer a cheap price, doesn't necessarily mean that it's a great value to wear one or two or three times and then you're tossing in the garbage. Versus buying, you know, high quality product that's going to last a long time, that's versatile, you can dress it up, dress it down. And I think we're starting to see a lot of the world moving in that direction. You know, there is definitely a tailwind around casualization. You know, jeans are now more acceptable in more places around the world. You know, you can wear it to work in many places, even investment banks now, you can wear a nice pair of jeans to work. So this notion of really tackling the consumption piece of it too is also a really big idea.
And do you attribute that? Because in some ways you could say, you know, the stereotype is that you would hire a consultant and they would come in and they would say, oh, well, you just need to shorten the lifespan of the jeans from 10 years to 3 years. And then people are going to buy them three times as much. And therefore you've got a three times increase in, and you know, sales and stuff like that. What's the value that you go back to that to say, no, that's planned obsolescence is not a, you know, a good strategy for the planet.
Right. It is not a good, and that's I guess maybe why we're not using consultants right now too. Yeah. And you know, a lot of people have said, you know, aren't you worried that, you know, this buy better, wear longer, you know, that it's gonna, hurt consumption of your brand? And I was like, no, the last time I looked, we don't have 100% market share. There's a big market share opportunity for us still. And, there's a lot of fast fashion denim out there that, is ripe for the picking, and a number of other competitive brands too. But at the end of the day, I think we've got to do, what is right, and driving over consumption is not the right thing to do. Getting consumers to focus on what represents a great price value, and we think Levi's represents a great price value, and that, that it is quality that never goes out of style, and having a couple of good solid pieces of Levi's in your closet is a great investment. And there's always the market share opportunity, which we can use to drive our revenue growth. And if that's not enough, we're going to have to figure out what else will drive our revenue growth. It's kind of that easy.
Yeah. Well, yeah. When you put it in terms like that, it does feel a little bit easier. And that's one of the things that I really appreciate about this conversation, Chip, is the giving the specifics, but those specific leads to different strategies that people can take. And so as we wrap up, maybe one last question to think about is, if for the leaders that are listening to this right now, any piece of advice on how or where to start? If they say, okay, I want to take a little bit more of a stand, I recognize it's not just about shareholder value, but the stakeholder value, like was reframed a few years ago. Where do people start? What do they begin with? How can they start to make that move?
Well, I think it's really important to, listen to your employees, listen to your customers, listen to your stakeholders. What actually got us into the whole gun issue, if you will, is we had a gun go off in one of our stores. A customer's gun went off in one of our stores. It was in an open carry state, and this guy was in the dressing room and dropped his trousers with his weapon in it, and it went off. And it could have killed one of my employees. It could have killed a child who was in the store with their parent, or could have killed the parent. It could have had a tragic outcome. The guy literally shot himself in the foot. And that is what got us into this. And my store manager is kind of saying, we're concerned. And that is ultimately what dragged us into this debate. So listening to your key stakeholders, I think, and really understanding what's important to them and really addressing those issues, I think is probably the best place to start.
Yeah, I was going to say, wonderful advice to start and start with the areas that are, like you said, in some ways personal. I think, do you, obviously with empathy, do you like have to be a woman to care about women's reproductive rights? No, not at all. If you have a connection to like, oh, but I do think about the context of my mom or my daughter or my wife or whatever, that's okay. It doesn't mean that you have to have those things to be supportive of it. But like you said, you didn't necessarily have to have the gun go off to know that. But if that becomes a starting incident to make this positive change, certainly well worth it.
Exactly. Very well said, Andrew.
Excellent. Well, Chip, thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation with us, to revisit both a conversation, a little bit about the impact that John Snell had in terms of this type of leadership that you're bringing now to Levi's, as well as to what other leaders can do kind of in this broader role of the new CEO and senior leaders within business. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me, Andrew. Great talking with you.
And that's our show. Like what you've heard, please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at pgalumpod. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the P&G Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former P&Gers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment in communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
That's it for this week. I've been Andrew Tarvin.
And I'm still Roman Segal. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.